Well, hello, ladies, gentlemen, children of all ages. Welcome to another TheOneLiner.com podcast. I am Scott Morris. Joining me for the rest of this podcast will be Drew Tavendale. This, as it turns out, is the second part of our mammoth three-episode catch-up session. So, without any further ado, let's just dive back into catching up on various old films. RoboCop. That's the biggest build-up that I think this film will probably ever get. This is a reboot, of course, of the Paul Verhoeven film, and puzzlingly, it bears very little in common with the original RoboCop, apart from the name RoboCop and the fact that there's a guy called Alex Murthy who has turned into said robot cop. It's set, again, nearish future Detroit. Alex Murthy is injured in the line of duty and eventually agrees to have himself turned into a robotic cop under the auspices of Gary Oldman's Dr. Dennett Norton. Omnicorp, in this instance, run by Michael Keaton. The issue that I've got with RoboCop is that it is actually a perfectly acceptable film, but not one that should really have the name RoboCop attached to it, because it's just giving it a whole bunch of baggage that it doesn't really need, and a lot of false expectations, I'd say, based on what came before it, because it's not really the same. And as much as you can do these kind of things in what is basically a slightly stupid sci-fi film, it's dealing with completely different issues of identity and humanity than the original RoboCop did, and it's approaching it in fairly different ways as well. Obviously, Verhoeven has his own particular style, and this is nothing like it. Director Jose Padilla from Elite Squad fame giving a different take on things here, and it's not entirely unsuccessful. I think this is actually a pretty decent film, and if you'd called it something different, something other than RoboCop, would probably have been a lot better received and a lot better regarded. I think this is actually a perfectly decent film and is worth watching, as long as you can completely divorce the original RoboCop film from this one entirely. Arguably, that's the only way to go about a reboot that it makes it worth something. There's no point simply doing the same film again just for modern audiences. That's pretty much redundant. So in a way, I can appreciate what they've done here and try and take a slightly different take on it. I just think it would have been better if you just did a completely different titled film instead. Yeah, perfectly acceptable, but it's not RoboCop. I'm probably going around in circles here, but there's no point remaking a film if you're going to do the same thing again. But if you do something different, then there's no point calling it the same of the old film. So what I'm saying here is basically, rather than keep remaking things, why not just make new films? Why have this weird link to the past?
It's I've never suggested that thousands of times at all. That, you know, instead of just rebooting things or making sequels or prequels, but just make a new thing.
Yeah.
So we've managed it for hundreds of years. Could we not just make a new thing? There we go. Yeah, I'm largely in agreement with you, Scott. It's a perfectly serviceable action sci-fi movie. I don't rate Joel Kinnaman particularly highly. I don't find him particularly engaging. But at the same time, he's mostly got some silly plastic armour on and is meant to be vaguely robotic. So it's not so much of an issue. Yeah, it's so hamstrung by being called RoboCop when it was completely unnecessary. With just a few changes, perhaps in design, and then not using certain names and phrases, it could have been an entirely serviceable, quite enjoyable action film. But no, it's called itself RoboCop, brings all that baggage with it, and it's
a sort of action film where the biggest conflict on it is actually a Senate vote that happens off screen.
Yes.
So yeah. That does say something about it, what its chops are.
Yeah, I certainly can't hate on this the way that I did and continue to hate on the remake of Total Recall. I mean, perhaps that is the single greatest thing you can say in RoboCop's favour, is that it's not Total Recall. It's not anything like as pointless as that was, but also doesn't do quite the same disservice to the original. But again, in a world where the original still exists and access to it is incredibly easy,
yeah,
there is no reason for it to be called RoboCop. Just to like hammer on this point if we haven't done so enough. Right, Lucy, from the mind of Luc Besson, and this time also from the director's chair of Luc Besson, so possibly from the behind of Luc Besson, which would explain a lot. Scarlett Johansson plays Lucy, a student, American student studying in South Asia. She, through her rather scummy boyfriend, gets inadvertently involved in the dealing of a new type of narcotic, which it turns out is some sort of super drug. She is knocked out and wakes up to find that a bag of this rather nasty chemical is inside her body, which was nice of them. Yeah, she's forced to smuggle this stuff inside of her body to France. But before she gets there, she's attacked by one of her captors, kicked repeatedly in the stomach, and the bag bursts. Instead of the usual impact of a massive bag of drugs bursting in her stomach, you know, very, very instant death, she instead becomes some sort of mad superhero. And the film gets stupider from that point on. Now, I just want to pound on a point here that really, really annoys me about this film. It's a pet hate of mine. It's a really weirdly persistent myth, and the entire film is based on it. And it's this myth, mysteriously persistent and utterly idiotic myth, that we only use 10% of the capacity of our brains. And this is central to the film, which makes it a big problem. It makes no sense, it's very, very stupid, but the film takes it very, very seriously. The idea goes that we only use 10% of our brains. If we could use 20%, we'd basically be able to rule the world. If we used 100%, we'd basically be able to control matter. It's a progression that I don't quite follow, but the film puts a lot of stock in because that's what happens. This drug that Scarlett Johansson has ingested is so miraculous that it affects her body in a way that allows her to, by unlocking the untapped regions of her mind, hear stuff happening on the other side of the world, control all televisions, melt, take on dozens of armed men, use telekinesis, and become the greatest genius there's ever been. All of which is quite impressive for some stuff that looks like sherbet. It's rubbish. it's a crap superhero movie, is what it is. I had an argument with somebody who said, it's not a superhero movie. It is. Person gets exposed to some chemical by accident, develops superpowers. That's a superhero movie. Except this one is really, really boring and really, really stupid, even by the realms of superhero movies. Don't watch it. I mean, that's all I want to say about it. It's really boring, it doesn't make any sense, and the entire thing is predicated on that really, really stupid myth of you only use 10% of your brain, and if you use 100% of it, you turn into God. Which is quite impressive, really. Really stupid. Yes, it's terrible. Avoid.
Apparently this film took 9 years to make. Sorry, Luke. You wasted your time. Right, firing on. Saving Mr. Banks. The author of Mary Poppins goes to meet Walt Disney and they talk. It's all right. And Elstad? No. I mean, with faint praise, but I wasn't expecting to like it at all, but it works quite well. Decent chemistry between Emma Thompson and Tom Hanks. The sort of prissy English battering up against the laconic charm of Walt Disney. Lots of decent support. Can't really complain about it too much. Solid piece of entertainment.
It's well made. There's some decent chemistry. A couple of entertaining scenes. It's nothing special, but it's worth watching. It's quite interesting. It's the varnished public face of Walt Disney, not the rather unsavoury political beliefs, which would have been more interesting, but perhaps not in keeping with the story about Mary Poppins.
Mm.
But yeah, it was, your first sentence was quite reductive, but actually quite accurate.
Yeah.
Man and women meet, talk.
Have conflict, resolve conflict, reach resolution, film ends.
Yes. Okay, Secret Life of Walter Mitty then. Directed by and starring Ben Stiller, with support from Kristen Wiig. Walter Mitty is a rather conservative person who dreams a lot all the time but never follows through on anything. He's consistently imagining himself in daredevil scenarios as a big go-getter or an action star. And really, he's just a person who catalogues negatives for Life magazine, which largely is the sponsor of the film. Due to a missing photograph, he eventually finds out that he has to go on these adventures for real. And there are quite a few set pieces of him running away from volcanoes and climbing up mountains in Afghanistan, all the while really exploring the character that he wanted to be. And it's all very ho-hum. I mean, Ben Stiller's likeable enough in it, but the whole film just is underwhelming. And I struggle to articulate quite why that is. I think the fact that it's so full of sponsorship does it no favours at all, because it feels like an advert.
Yeah.
It's really, really glossy and it feels like an advert, or like the sort of scene that you might get an Apple demonstration telling you how people use the new camera features. So much of the film feels like that, and let's say it's got Life magazine in it as they're publishing their last print issue, and that's so prominent that they're clearly involved in its production. There are lots of other brand names in there. It's very much style over substance. And it's not a bad film, but it's just, it's not that easy to care about Walter so much because none of it seems real. the whole film feels quite like his dreams, and there's not really that much differentiation between the tone of them. So it doesn't ever feel like these are things happening to him. It still feels like it could reach the end of the film and you think he's going to wake up and have it all been a dream. And it's just so glossy, but it means there's no friction and there's nothing to hold on to. It's kind of a disappointment because some of the early, again, while still feeling like an advert, but he's sort of daydreaming it and then suddenly bursts out of the advertising hoarding next to him where it had the Mountaineer in it and then it's him. There are wee bits like that that modern CGI stuff allows that actually makes for quite interesting prospects that it never really uses well enough. There's nothing to hold on to there, nothing to get a hook into that would make you really want to engage with the character. But it's one of the best performances I've seen from Ben Stiller in a while, probably since, I mean, I've not seen him all that much since, but probably since Tropic Thunder. And nothing is like as over the top as that. It's a more reserved performance. And it works, actually. It's rather than these much more goofy stuff, which I've never cared much for. But it's very much style over substance, this. Feels very thin. Basically, this film's like Nouvelle Cuisine. It looks really, really good, but if you bite into it and there's just no substance there, it's gone in a second. There. Nouvelle Cuisine from the 1980s. There's my cutting edge, up-to-date, modern take on this. It's like Nouvelle Cuisine.
This film's like Spangles. Does anyone remember Spangles?
Daily Boppers. I think those were 80s.
Pat Sharp's Funhouse. This film's like one of the twins out of Pat Sharp's Funhouse. You bite into her and no, that doesn't work. 47 Ronin, the latest in the long-running Ronin series, which starred Rob De Niro back in 1998 or something, I don't know. By any objective measure, 47 Ronin's a terrible film, but it just happens to combine a couple of things that I really like the sort of the samurai era, nice armour, and I still, for some reason, have a soft spot for Keanu Reeves of late, so I'm not as down on it as everyone else seems to be, although objectively, it's not very good. Keanu Reeves himself plays Kai, a half Japanese, half English, I believe they said, fella who's sort of outcast in the society that he's brought up in. He's another samurai, kind of bully him or something, but he has a relationship with the lords of the area's daughter. So there's some kind of sort of sexual tension there, some attraction there that can never be realised. Things come to a head when the leader of the arrival prefecture, I think prefecture may be the wrong technical term there, but you know what I mean, comes and starts causing some bother and uses the strange supernatural powers of his resident witch to take over this other region, thus causing the samurai that were in the good lord's pay to become unemployed ronin, who, you know, samurai without a master, and they then choose to take revenge for their lord. And for the most part, it is a, well, first off, the 47 ronin is one of the sort of most lauded and referred to examples of kind of Japanese honour and the sort of myths of the samurai and things like that, and this takes massive liberties with it. To be honest, I could have done without all of the supernatural bullshit and it would have been a far stronger film without it. However, that said, it's still kind of enjoyable in a sort of really, really stupid way. The supernatural stuff is largely left to Keanu Reeves and the assorted witches to kind of battle out, and it's almost taking place as a sort of completely different story to the battles that the Oishi's leader of the samurai band, played by Hiroyuki Sanada, is dealing with the more mundane matters of the battles with the terrestrial samurai and things of the opposing lord. And that side of stuff, the stuff that is really more rooted in the Japanese legend, works quite well, and I'm a sucker for that sort of thing anyway, so I was quite happy to see that. The stuff with the supernatural elements kind of doesn't, it looks kind of ropey, and even though I like Keanu Reeves, he's not the best kind of person to sort of have this be a linchpin around, doesn't ruin it too badly, but it is kind of hard to recommend. Like I say, if you've got the same sort of combination of weaknesses that I do, you'll find some enjoyment out of this. I've seen far worse stupid films, but I can't in all honesty really recommend it to anybody. The Lego Movie is a film with Lego in it, and it's mildly amusing, and that's about as much as I really care to say about it. Going by the note, I think you've got a bit more to say about it than I do.
I have a little bit.
The only other thing I'd add, could have done without that framing device at the end. That was stupid. Don't really need a rationale for a film about Lego. Just make a film about Lego. Fine, don't care. Yeah, go ahead.
it's quite astonishingly preachy, and I didn't care for it at all. All bits that were supposed to be amusing I found fell incredibly flat. and it just really, really annoyed me. One of the biggest problems I had, actually, was that the whole film is based on the idea that you should not follow the instructions and create your own thing and be this wonderful master builder and be creative and freely expressive, which is really weird based on a toy, especially nowadays, which is incredibly prescriptive and encourages you to follow the instructions at all times, which I find a bit of a mixed message. And it's just got that tone to it of, like, do you remember the He-Man cartoons? Where at the end of every episode, Man-at-Arms or Orko would appear and tell you what moral message you ought to have taken from the cartoon.
Yeah, don't be a skeleton, mainly.
Friends are important, etc. This whole film has that tone to it. The whole thing is so, so preachy that I really feel it ought to be called the Lego Sermon. It has that terrible Everything is Awesome song in it, too, which doesn't help. And I had a discussion with somebody about this, like, people were liking it in an ironic way, but the way I've seen people talking about it, I don't believe it at all. I think people like this. It's terrible. I mean, it's sub-90s Europop terrible. Eiffel 65's Blue to Be is a step above. I just didn't find it funny or entertaining. It certainly doesn't need a justification at the end. Can you not just make it a bit of Lego? There we go. That'd have been fine.
I obviously didn't think about it enough to care about that sort of thing. I thought it was mildly amusing. I liked Will Arnett as Batman, and I would happily sign up to see the Will Arnett Batman Lego movie that is apparently going to happen. I'll give that a bash, because that sounds like it will just be stupid fun rather than trying to preach at people. Sorry, I don't mind it. That's my recommendation for it. I don't mind it. It's not horrible.
Glowing recommendation, 10 out of 10.
Blancmange out of 10.
The Book Thief, then, based on Marcus Zusak's novel of the same name. It's about a young girl called Liesl who is dumped by her mother for reasons that I don't remember being adequately explained on a family in a small town in Germany during World War II. She meets the wife of the Burgermeister, who gives her a book. And then after that, she takes to sneaking into the house and stealing books. And then she reads the books. And at some point, the family she's with take in a Jewish refugee who she helps look after in the basement while he's ill. And she reads the books to him. And it ends. That's the story. It feels like there should be something more interesting here in, like, seeing what was happening in the war from the German side, which is certainly far less documented, at least in the Western cinema. But nothing really interesting happens. The Gestapo coming round to knock on the door and check for people harbouring Jewish people. It's been done often enough. It's unremarkable in this case. Not what was happening, just how it's portrayed in the film. Don't get me wrong. The story just isn't very interesting. It's very well regarded, but I think it's one of those things that's like, oh, we've got the Germans dealing with the Jews, it's therefore worthy, in a way that so often a film about mental health issues is. It's not automatically worthy, though. This one's really dull. Again, it's very thin. There's nothing much going on here. The wee girl has seen the world of some rather unpleasant things happening, but she survives well enough. She doesn't really see the worst horrors, and the film ends. There we go. Really hit. Nothing exciting happens in this film. Nothing worthwhile happens. It's, yeah.
Maybe you should have stole a better book to base the film on then, eh?
A couple of years ago, we were absolutely delighted by a film. It was easily one of our films of the year. It was a pure, joyous, really silly, deeply entertaining thing. And that was Jason Segel's reboot of The Muppets. It was brilliant. Now, if you think about that film, and remember all the charm and wit and fun and the charm and mostly the charm. You remember all that. See if you take all of that away, especially the charm, and replace it with Ricky Gervais. There, you have Muppets Most Wanted. Do you need to know any more? Probably not, but it misses all the charm of the first film. It also, while in a much reduced role, continues to have Walter, which is a problem because I don't know anybody in the first film that liked Walter. In this film, you've got the evil criminal mastermind Constantine, who is a frog that bears an uncanny resemblance to a certain other frog. And he takes his place, and nobody in the Muppets seems to notice, while the real Kermit is languishing in a Russian prison. Kermit must extricate himself and stop Constantine's dastardly plans to steal the crown jewels of the United Kingdom. And there are some loosely connected sketches in between, and yeah, it's okay, I guess. I mean, it has quite a lot of Ricky Gervais, and that's quite a lot too much.
Yes, science has determined the appropriate amount of Ricky Gervais in any film, and that amount is zero.
Yes, this is correct. I mean, to be fair to him, he's not completely awful. He isn't the biggest problem. It's the lack of charm. Possibly it's the difficulty in a second film with recapturing that magic, but it's not there. And it almost makes it worse that right at the start of the film, they address the fact it's not going to be as good by talking about the fact they're in a sequel that won't be as good. That really sort of knowing wink to the audience about it just makes that worse.
Yeah.
And there's some decent songs in there. I didn't care for most of them, but there are a few that are quite interesting. A musical bit with Tina Fey and a really entertaining bit with Jermaine Clement as a Russian prisoner with his absolutely silly accent, way worse than Kenneth Branagh and Jack Ryan, actually. That's quite entertaining. But as for the rest of it, songs are lackluster. There aren't as many laughs as there are in the first one. There's nothing quite so silly as Gonzo's plumbing business destruction button or 80s robot. And it feels like it was made... The first one felt like it was made with love of the Muppets. This one feels like it was made with love of money. That's the difference. This seems like a weird thing to say, but the first film, because by dint of the fact people didn't really believe in the Muppets anymore, they'd been legendary for having massive celebrity cameos before. They didn't really have that many in the first film, and the biggest star they could get was Jack Black. In this film, there's no mega stars by any means, but you know, they've amped up the number and the star rating of the cameos. And it kind of suffers for it, actually, because turns out Jack Black was better than most of the people in this film. Make of that what you will. Yes, it's not quite a crushing disappointment, but it's a disappointment. It misses what made the first new Muppets film quite so special. That'll do you.
On to Ender's Game, based on the beloved Orson Scott Card novel. Orson Scott Card. I never like to pass up the opportunity to mention that he is one of the most horrible human beings on Earth, but he can write good books, so you need to do that bit of dissociation if you want to read any of his stuff.
Yeah, which I certainly can for the most part when his output doesn't really match his own beliefs.
Yeah.
Which it doesn't, does it? I've not read the book, but it really matches his own politics, I believe.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. So Ender's Game has been talking about developing this film for, I believe, as long as any of us have been alive. It's been in development hell for a long time. This is a reasonable adaptation of the book. It's an interesting exemplar of how you can really kind of screw up most of the central premise of a book, not by making any one particular big change, but just by lots of fairly minor tweaks here and there, each one of which can be described fairly rationally in terms of just cramming it into a two-hour-ish film, just for pacing reasons. But the cumulative effect of that kind of lessens the impact of everything that happens in it. Brief synopsis: Andrew Ender Wiggin is a young prodigy who is taken into battle school, the idea being that we need to take kids from their very infancy and to train them up into be kind of battle-hardened warriors and strategic geniuses in order to prepare for an oncoming onslaught by an alien race called the Formix, an insectoid race that previously visited Earth and we only just managed to survive. So it follows Ender as he goes through training school and the various trials and tribulations that comes of being bullied and deliberately isolated by his trainers, headed up by Harrison Ford's Colonel Gruff. I think it's pronounced Graff, but it is mainly Gruff because it's Harrison Ford, and that's how he does things these days. That is the most accurate Harrison Ford impersonation that you will ever hear.
Uncanny.
Yes. So as a result of all this, he becomes battle-hardened and is sharpened to the point, the pointy weapon that we need to go and defeat the Formix. I can't really give you too many examples of things that have changed here, but it's without, you know, getting into spoiler territory, but it's these little things where people that in the book died didn't in this, and it just sort of takes bits of edges off to try and make it a bit more likeable, and they've changed a little bits of what happens with the technology here and there just to try and, well, not have like just someone having to explain for 5 minutes how something works, and sort of tweak little bits here and there, but it tends to make everything be a little less sensible, and to the point that when you get to the end of the film, it's sort of lost a hell of a lot of the impact that it could have had. But then again, that would have made the film a lot longer, and I think it's probably not a strong enough story to really warrant that. I like Ender's Game well enough as a book. I think the next book in the series is much better, but it's just lost quite a lot in the transition to film. But I don't think it's by any stretch a bad film. It's perfectly acceptable entertainment, and it tells its own story reasonably well. It does a pretty decent job of kind of keeping things moving along and not losing you in technological holes or anything like that. But I just think it doesn't really say an awful lot about either society or the character of Wigan at the end of the day. It's filed off too many of the rough edges of the story just to try and make it a little bit more acceptable and keep it going a bit more smoothly, and by the time you get to the end, it's filed off so much that it's lost any point. Not a bad film, but something of a missed opportunity. A lot of the elements that I think could have made this really successful are there, but it just doesn't quite fall together correctly.
I don't know the book, although there's enough here that it's made me intrigued enough to go and read it. This is rated 12A. It actually feels like it's pitched a bit younger.
Yeah.
And I think that's perhaps why it doesn't have quite the edge that it probably ought to have.
Yeah.
It's competently produced. It looks nice enough in places. Asa Butterfield is pretty watchable. The problem with it is that there's some really interesting things in there. The idea of child soldier, and I guess I've not read the book, so I don't know how much this is explored there, but the idea of effectively child soldiers, the morality of that, the ethics around it, the idea of what Ender is forced to do at the end, how that would impact on anybody, let alone a child. There's lots of really interesting, tantalising themes in there that could be really, if you could get your teeth into, could be really interesting to explore. And they're just not there.
Yeah.
It's a bit calorie light in that regard, which is a real pity because as the themes are quite interesting. You could make a much more substantial movie out of it. But whether it's because, as you say, they've cut off areas to fit it into film, or I suspect this may be closer to the main bulk of it, of the, it's clearly aimed at a younger audience. It's not a children's film as such, but it definitely feels maybe a young teen film at most.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, the books are as well. They're sort of young adult kind of pitched levels.
Yeah, so, I wasn't sure I was going to ask about that. So, I mean, I guess the pitch is appropriate from where the books are pitched in, but it just feels like the edge that it needs that would make it a really compelling thing to watch isn't there.
Yeah, exactly.
Snowpiercer, film by Korean director Jun Ho Bong, written by him and adapted from a French graphic novel by Jacques Loeb. This is set in a dystopian future where, to combat global warming, many nations of the Earth seeded the atmosphere with a chemical compound that was designed to bring down the global temperature. To the surprise of absolutely no one, this went too far and created a global ice age, which basically froze and killed everybody. Apart from the very lucky few that happened to be aboard the magical super train, which basically just tells the cold to keep moving and get out of the way. So in this train, there are the rich people, the haves, at the front end, and in the tail section, the grimy dregs of what's left of humanity. Well, dregs as the people at the front see them, but clearly we don't because we are not scum. Amongst this group are a leader called Gilliam, played by John Hurt, and the leader in waiting, Curtis, played by Chris Evans. Now they're plotting to overpower the guards and make their way to the front of the train and take it over. That's a fairly conventional story. What makes it interesting is that it's all taking place within a train. Very confined atmosphere, long and narrow, real sense of progression there. It's all quite interesting. There's certainly the seeds of an interesting idea in there. Unfortunately, the world just doesn't seem to work. Now, the first part, I'll say, is possibly you consider I'm nitpicking, but this film sets itself in 2014. So, you know, now. Somehow there's a magic train that's appeared on a magic round-the-world railroad that crosses all the oceans. And this bothers me because it's a magic train. Many hundreds of years into the future, it wouldn't bother me at all. It's set in 2014. Well, rather, it starts in 2014. It's set 17 years later. But obviously, with everybody on Earth dying, technology won't have improved any. They're stuck with what they had in 2014. Now, I've been on trains. They're rubbish. They can't make them run in time between Glasgow and Edinburgh. They're not making them run round the entire planet for 17 years without stopping. But I digress. Well, I don't actually. I may bang about on about this train for a bit longer, but no. So there's that. The technology doesn't work, and so much of it's based on a technology that doesn't make any sense. Nobody maintains the rails. Yeah, this thing can go around in massively sub-zero temperatures for 17 years. There's no mention of how it's fueled. Magic, presumably. Or possibly it's nuclear powered, but it's never explained, and that's an issue because where are you going to get fuel? Where did they get a nuclear train in 2014? It's annoying me so much because there's a seed of such an interesting idea in here. But the other part where the world doesn't work is that the time frame feels compressed. You've had these people living on this train for 17 years. It's all they see, and I imagine psychologically that would affect people a lot, particularly people in the rear who have no windows. But there's already a religion of the train and people talking about the great benevolent engine. And if this were several generations down the line, I'd buy that. I'd buy the fact that they're on this train and the train gives life and a philosophy or religion swung up around that. Not when nearly everybody in a train lived in the world before the apocalypse and the language has changed in a way that, again, several generations down the line would make sense. People referring to the whole wide train instead of the whole wide world, but not when most people remember the whole wide world. Now, that may sound like nitpicking. I'm open to that criticism. But there's just a few bits like that that just set me off a bit, and they just mean the world doesn't quite hold together and I don't buy the world, and that's a problem. Other things about the world building that just don't make sense to me too. You have several hundred people in this tail section. They're grimy, they're ill-treated, their children are stolen, and they're treated like scum by the rest of the train. And while something in the end portion of the film tries in some way to explain it, it doesn't make any sense why they're there. So resources are limited, and the people on the train feed these people at the back, who they treat with scum, these protein blocks to keep them fed. But they must be a drain on the resources, but there's no reason why they seem to keep them around. If they were there as some sort of working underclass and basically slave labour in this dystopian future, that works, that makes sense. They don't seem to do anything. They're just there, which it just, every step forward is not a step back, because it seems to break the world and the world doesn't make sense and you can't get invested in it. Well, let's move forward. So they move through the train, they attempt to overpower the guards and make their way to the front to confront the man who's basically like an evil Howard Hughes running his train from his rarefied atmosphere at the front. There's a seed of an interesting idea in here, the dystopian future based on global warming, the fact it went wrong, it went cold. It's quite interesting, and certainly it's beautifully shot. Lots of different settings, some really nice camera works, and a nice, particularly memorable scene which is shot entirely off of the light of a flaming torch. I mean, stylistically, it's really compelling, but other bits, they get in the way. Odd tonal shifts too. The idea of a classroom full of children being schooled in the ideology of the train, that I buy. Tilda Swinton as some strange Yorkshire woman speaking in a, with a silly set of dentures, terrible glasses, and really, really, really weird speech pattern just doesn't fit. It takes you out of it again because it doesn't seem to fit in the world. There are definite elements of Terry Gilliam in here, and there's no way it's a coincidence that John Hurt's character is called Gilliam. But in the way that in a Terry Gilliam film, either the world would work or the rest of it would be so compelling you wouldn't care is missing here. I consider it a squandered opportunity, actually. The idea is compelling. The setting, it being so limited, being a train, being linear, there's nowhere for people to escape. They have to keep pushing forward. It all says there's a seed of a good idea in here. It's just very poorly executed. Again, I keep coming back, the world just doesn't work. It bothers me. Instead of watching what happens when they move to the aquarium car and wondering what the next twist in the tale is going to be and how they're going to deal with the next thing they have to face, I'm thinking, There's an aquarium on this train. How does that work? How does it get around corners? It keeps failing at that point, and I can't get my head to ignore that bit. It's a problem. Again, it's worth watching. It's a nicely shot film and it's interesting, but it just fails in its execution, unfortunately.
So basically, if you've been less horribly scarred by ScotRail, then you might have a good chance of getting on with it.
Yes.
Hector and the Search for Happiness. I rather like the one-line description in IMDb for this one. A psychiatrist searches the globe to find the secrets of happiness. Turns out that that is to not run away from your problems like a pansy. But apparently Hector, played by Simon Pegg, was not a good enough psychiatrist to work that out by himself. So he's having some issues with his relationship with wife Rosamund Pike, Clara. And as part of this, he decides to go for a voyage of discovery to find himself and do research on this book to, you know, find this... what makes people happy. It starts off, amiably enough, as a sort of whimsical little quirky type comedy as he takes off to China and things like that, and then all of a sudden a rather strange element of tonal whiplash as it decides to descend into periods of bleak misery before kind of bouncing back into whimsical territory again towards the end, and frankly it just doesn't work. It has its moments of charm, it has its occasional moments of where it's quite funny, but as a film taken together, it just kind of doesn't really work very well. It's not horrible, but it's just plainly strange. I can't really say I know what they were trying to go with here. It's a very strange mixture of vignettes of story and rapidly changing tone, and at the end, it doesn't really say anything of any particular note for something that has such lofty goals as having character going off to try and discover what makes people happy. It kind of fails miserably at getting anywhere close to even examining that point. The best that can be said is, the character comes to the realisation that, yes, he shouldn't have just run away from his problems. Fine, but I think most of us already kind of knew that. Doesn't really say a lot, doesn't really warrant watching, I don't think. I've seen worse films, but I've not seen too many films that really just don't hang together as a concept as well as this. There will be no doubt some people, like the hardcore Simon Pegg fans, who will really just love it because it's another chance to see him do his stuff. And there's a few other decent performances. Most of the cast acquits themselves fairly well. It just doesn't hang together as a concept, and that's the problem with it. I would recommend passing up on this one.
Next we have Monuments Men, directed by and starring George Clooney. This is the story of a special platoon put together during World War II in the final stages of the war to rescue priceless artworks, etc., that were looted by the Nazis during their occupation of Europe. As they're retreating, they are willfully destroying these. And George Clooney thinks it would be a massive loss to society to allow these artworks to be destroyed, and approaches the government to allow him to put together a special platoon to go and stop it. A platoon, rather than being made of soldiers though, being made of historians and art experts and possibly even archaeologists. So basically it's like the Antiques Roadshow version of Inglourious Basterds. Yeah, it's the Dirty Dozen of some really rather boring academics. And they get into a few scuffles militarily, but mostly they're just going around looking for clues about where all the treasures are hidden. It's a bit dull, unfortunately. Yeah, but more to say about it. It's some people collecting some paintings. Nothing much happens. Move on.
I expected more, given the cast, but it's not so much that any of them are bad, it's just that they don't really bring anything particularly unique to any of the roles. There's not really much to play. For what it's worth, I thought it was fine when I was watching it. It didn't put me out in any way. I thought it was reasonably entertaining for the time, but I've thought about it precisely none since watching it several months back, and I don't think I will ever think of it again once we're finished editing this podcast. By no means a blot on anyone's career, but there's just not really a great deal to it.
When I'm saying they're basically going around getting paintings, that's
mainly it, yeah.
Productive, but only in the very slightest manner. There's just nothing much happens, that's it. And again, it's got a stellar cast and Cate Blanchett. They do the best they can with what they've got, but yet Bill Murray is wasted in this, which is probably the biggest crime it commits, but it's just underwhelming in almost every way. If you watched it, you're not going to feel like you watched something hateful and terrible, but you might consider that you could have spent 2 hours doing something else instead.
Well, again, I think that's quite enough for you to be getting on with. We will be back next week with the final part of our catch-up session, where we talk about some of the films that we actually liked quite a lot. In the meantime, if you want to contact us, you can drop us an email, podcast@theoneliner.com, or you can hit us up on Twitter, @theoneliner. So, until next time, take care of yourself and each other. Snowpiercer! Wah, wah, wah. The man with a golden piercer. or something like that.
For some reason, I thought you were going to say knob.